Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. So good to have you here. America lost a hero this week with General Colin Powell. Obviously, he was a trailblazer in so many ways. He was the first black chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff. He was the first black national security advisor. He was the first black Secretary of State. He was a trailblazer, even though he didn't seek to be a trailblazer for African Americans. He was. And you look back over his storied career, he did so many things so well. And I'm going to talk to Richard Haass, who's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, who began working with Colin Powell in 1979 and 1980. But, you know, Powell for me was an Eisenhower type figure. He was a Republican, but he was a bit more moderate, at times more moderate than me on policy issues. But his temperament, I think, more importantly, was moderate. And I had the greatest respect for him because, like Eisenhower, this guy was not interested in ideology. He was not interested in political poses. He really only cared about what worked. Richard, this morning on Morning Joe, talked about how he remembered Colin Powell working on VWs back in the 1960s, 1970s. I always heard the story of Colin Powell, who would be out in his driveway fixing up old Volvos. And for him, it was about taking something that was broken or something that needed to be upgraded and fixing it, making something work. Powell was, first and foremost, he was a soldier. He was a soldier in the Vietnam War, and he saw the hell of Vietnam from 65 to 73. He saw American troops being put through a war that didn't have the support of most Americans, that didn't have the force that they needed to complete their mission, and really didn't have a stated objective, a stated end game. So as Secretary of Defense Cap Weinberger's assistant, he worked with Weinberger, Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Defense, to put together the doctrine that we remember now as the Weinberger Doctrine, which says before you go to war, you have to have the support of the American people, you have to have a stated objective, you have to have an end game. This is so important. You have to have a goal that's your triggering point to get out of that war. What's the goal you want to achieve to leave? And then Colin Powell added overwhelming force. When you go to war, you don't half-ass it. You don't do what he saw in Vietnam time and time again, where you take a hill, you lose a hill. You take a hill, you lose a hill. You take 100 yards, you lose 100 yards. And there's not an overriding objective. What Colin Powell always said was leading into the first Gulf War, when we go to war, we don't want a fair fight. We want to use overwhelming force. We want to get in there. We want to get the job done. And then we want to bring our sons and our daughters home. It was an important message that Americans needed to hear after Vietnam. And it was John Meacham has said, David Ignatius has said that Colin Powell actually helped rebuild America's faith in the United States military after Vietnam. He certainly did. He's a great American hero and a trailblazer. And I'll tell you something else that I saw this morning, and I'm just looking down at my Twitter feed. Something I saw after his passing is unlike anything I've seen in quite some time, and that is one figure, one political figure that actually seemed to be a unifying force in America. Democrats, obviously, were very critical of Colin Powell in the lead up to the second Iraq War, his speech at the United Nations, where he got bad information and used it on weapons of mass destruction. Republicans, very critical at times of Colin Powell, especially movement conservatives, because here was a guy that was not comfortable with the far-right wing of the Republican Party, with movement conservatives. In 2008, he came out and he endorsed Barack Obama. He said he didn't like where the Republican Party was going, and he continued being critical of where that party was going in the lead up to Donald Trump. And of course, when Donald Trump was president of the United States, he certainly was critical of what he saw as an abandonment of Western-style democracy, of constitutional checks and balances, the moving away of that by his former party. That said, I was so heartened today to see people in both parties, both Republicans, Democrats, liberals, and conservatives, saying positive things about Colin Powell. Nick Burns, who's going to be Joe Biden's ambassador to China, said this: "General Colin Powell was one of our greatest public servants, a courageous and inspirational leader for both the State Department and the military, admired by all who worked for him, a true patriot." Reverend Al Sharpton said, "My condolences for the family of Colin Powell. Though we disagreed on many issues, I always respected him and was always proud of his achievements. When he and I ran into each other and conversed, I always left feeling that he was sincere and committed to the things that he believed in. Rest in peace." Robert Draper, the great writer for the New York Times, said Colin Powell was a heroic American figure tinged with tragedy owing to his February 2003 UN speech on Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction. But he was the only senior advisor to President Bush to warn him about the consequences of going into Iraq. Richard Haass, who we're going to be talking to in a minute, said after the passing of his colleague and good friend, "He was the most intellectually honest person I ever met. He was anti-ideology, anti-camp. He was open-minded. He was consistently adjusting his worldview." Admiral James Trevidas said, "Colin Powell was the North Star to a generation of senior American officers, including me. The first call I made for advice when I was selected as NATO commander was to him. Godspeed and open waters to a general for the ages." And I could go on and on. So many great people saying great things about General Colin Powell, a true patriot, a soldier, and a man who loved this country, and a man for whom this country needs to be deeply, deeply grateful. Let's bring in now Richard Haass. He is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, also a friend of General Powell, who spent an awful lot of time with him. And Richard, it started in the Carter administration in the Department of Defense in 79 and 80, and you happened to be working with a young, bright, rising star at that time. Tell us about him.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Colin Powell at that point was a lieutenant colonel or a colonel. The Secretary of Defense always has several military assistants. He was one of them. And someone said you should get to know him because he was someone who knew how to make the building work. And needless to say, I did not. So I remember standing in this fancy outer office and he was just working the phones in the way look, you're a musician. In the way that a musician might work a keyboard or guitar strings, he was working the phones. And he just checked in with everybody constantly. And what was interesting to me is often the call didn't have a specific purpose. The person who later comes to mind in this was George H.W. Bush. The idea that you'd call people or take calls from people almost as an investment in a relationship, because you knew for sure the day would come when you would have a purpose to make a call or to take a call. And that's what I learned from watching Colin, was that effectiveness in a bureaucracy depended so much upon relationships. And for someone like me coming out of academia, that was a really good early lesson.
So tell me about Colin Powell. Is there a moment in your life working with him that stands out? What to you made him so special personally and professionally?
There's several. We worked really closely under George H.W. Bush. I was the Middle East person at the National Security Council at the White House. He was the chairman. And we didn't always agree on what to do. And what I loved it is we clashed once or twice. I remember once it was when President Bush, I don't know if you remember the famous picture, he landed on the South Lawn of the White House. It was 3 or 4 days into the Gulf Crisis. It was August of 1990. And I met him at the helicopter and briefed him. That's when he said, "This will not stand. This aggression against Kuwait will not stand." Well, Colin was on his exercise bike at headquarters and nearly, as he said, nearly fell off And he basically said, what has Haas done? He basically totally bypassed the entire interagency process, and he put the president up to saying yeah. that. And he was the one, as the chairman, was going to have to actually implement the policy.
Right.
So we had a full frank and candid conversation after that, and several other times when we didn't always agree. What I loved it, though, is he could really take the bark off the tree with me.
Yeah,
I could do it with him. And then it was almost like a summer storm.
Mm-hmm.
It cleared, and then we would go back to our friendship. And again, it taught me something that almost if you have the foundation of friendship, you could just totally hammer each other and then move on. And the friendship would still be there. And that happened many times then. It happened later on when I worked for him directly. I only worked for him directly for a couple of years when he was Secretary of State and I was the head of policy planning. And again, we spent hours and hours and hours together, and you know, didn't always agree.
Yeah.
But he was totally comfortable with disagreeing. He actually, you know, the people. It's a cliche about speaking truth to power, but he was comfortable with it.
Yeah, and you know, for people listening who are in public service or thinking about getting into public service, I can't underline how important it is to have that type of relationship and that sort of character that you had and General Powell had, where you all could go at each other hard and then the next day move on to another topic. That is, for me, whenever I've come across somebody in public service like that who can put it behind them, I just sit back and I admire them and I go, that's a professional. And that's what Powell was. He was a professional.
Yeah, I remember once when we had a really rough conversation. I was unhappy with him, and he knew it. And we cleared the air, and he said, okay, so we're good now. And I said, yeah, we're good. We've been good a long time. We're good now. But it was just, again, it was so interesting that we could be profoundly unhappy with each other over something. And then in the ultimate sense, it didn't matter.
You know, this morning I talked, we talked on the show, but read off that he was the first Black National Security Advisor, first Black Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, first Black Secretary of State, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He was a trailblazer in so many ways, and yet it was kind of like Thatcher. I never thought of Thatcher as a female prime minister. I thought of Thatcher as a prime minister who happened to be a woman. It's the same thing with Colin Powell, where it's not something he talked about much, and it's not something you thought about much. And yet you turn around 30, 40 years later, and you understand that in terms of civil rights and moving forward African Americans in this country and in public service, in the military, in the White House, in politics, he's got to be at the top of just about any list in that category.
Yeah, you look at his resume, there's none other like it. And you're right, I hadn't thought of the Thatcher comparison, but you're exactly right. Neither one of them drew attention to it, wore it on their sleeve. But in some ways, Joe, that was the highest statement. The idea that you could be the first African-American, the first Black person to do all those jobs, or in her case, as prime minister, and not draw attention to it, that was the ultimate statement that things had changed. That was the ultimate statement of breakthrough. So Powell would never draw attention. Though I remember, on occasion, he would remind people in a funny sort of way that he was Black, and he would raise some issue to do, say, with civil rights or Black-white issues in America. He did it rarely, but he would do it. And I remember he did it once with President Bush, the father. And the fact that he didn't wear it on his sleeve made it all the more powerful. It was something that when he drew attention to it, you knew it really mattered. You knew there was something wrong that needed to be addressed.
Richard, talk about, if you will, the Powell Doctrine. Obviously, came out of the Weinberger Doctrine and updated by Colin Powell. Mm-hmm. Could you explain to people who may be too young to remember the Powell Doctrine,
sure,
what it was, what it said, and let me know what you think about how applicable it still is to where we are in 2021?
Yeah, what you had with the Weinberger and then the Powell Doctrines were basically a series of criteria that policymakers needed to apply before they would use military force. So it wasn't against the use of military force. It simply said, if you're going to use military force wisely, you ought to be able to check off these boxes. That, for example, the mission you assign is attainable. Don't ask military force to do something it's not designed to do. it tends to be designed to kill people and break things. It's not necessarily good at other things. Don't do it quickly or lightly. It should be almost consistent with so-called just war theory, Joe, Christian just war theory. Use it as a last resort. And things like that. It was a series of almost intellectual boxes that policymakers needed to think through before they would advocate for using it. And it led Powell to be a reluctant or cautious warrior, which I don't think is at all the worst thing for people in uniform. It made him argue for a lot of force in the Gulf War. He basically said, if you're going to give the military this task of destroying the Iraqi army in Kuwait, then give me enough force to do it. Don't tie my hands. He was, a lot of this was against incrementalism, the kind of gradualism of Vietnam. I think it's applicable. What I think, though, the Balkans, though, also show, and that's where he and Madeleine Albright had their big disagreement, is whether there are times you should be willing to use military force in ways that are, quote, signaling, or how would I call it, in limited fashion. And when you think about it, almost all uses of military force are limited. We don't use nuclear weapons. We don't use everything we have. You may be limited in your choice of targets or how much munitions. So I think there are gradations. What I think is great about the Powell Doctrine is not necessarily that every one of his criteria have to be met, but it's the intellectual rigor that has to go in the decision to use force and think it through. Like, one of his criteria was that there would essentially be an exit strategy, that you could leave the battlefield and leave things better off than they were beforehand.
Well, and Richard, most importantly for policymakers, before you go into war, before the first shot is fired, you have that exit strategy. You don't make it up as you go along. You have the aims that you want to achieve, the goals you want to achieve. You have the exit strategy, and then you go to war.
100%. And the reason Powell had doubts about the Iraq War in 2003 is that at both ends of it, he was unpersuaded. He was very uneasy that it was a last resort. It clearly wasn't a last resort. We had many other things we could and should have done dealing with sanctions and other tools. And he was very worried about the unilateralism. And yes, he was extraordinarily worried, in part because, like me, he had participated in the debates a decade before. And when George Bush 41, the father, did not go to Baghdad, we in many ways anticipated many of the problems that came in 2003 and the years after that. So Powell was extraordinarily cautious. But it was clear that the president, the 43rd president, had made up his mind. Let me tell you one story. It was the summer of 2002. So this is now 9 months before we went to war. And I had a meeting with Condi Rice, who was National Security Advisor. I was the head of policy planning at State. And I came back and I said, Colin, we got to meet. So we met right away. And I said, they've made the decision to go to war. Because she told me literally, Richard, save your breath. I was arguing against it. And she said, the president has made up his mind to go to war. And I came back and told Colin that. He said, you're nuts. You're nuts. And a few weeks later, he had dinner with the president. And he called me afterwards and he said, you were right. Mm. The president has made up his mind. And very quickly, the dinner turned from whether to go to war, because Powell realized that was a losing argument. And then the question was, what diplomatic steps did we have to take in the UN, with allies, with the Congress, in order to set the stage? So he basically realized very quickly the president had made up his mind. He was against it. So he changed gears. And he basically said, okay, Mr. President, you're taking on a lot here. Do not underestimate how hard this will be. But if you are determined to do this, here's the only way to do it.
So talk about the UN speech, the one really dark blot on his legacy. I've talked to people in the agency who were preparing the information, who told me how spotty they thought it was. Powell would question them, send things back. But at the end, he went and he gave the speech, something that obviously hangs over his legacy. What can you tell us about that?
Look, it does hang over his legacy. He got it wrong. We all got it wrong. What I remember, though, is something, and I'm sure this will drive the Twitter crowd crazy. When we got the original draft of the speech, it came from the vice president's office, from Scooter Libby. It was just junk. It was so loaded up with intelligence that really could not be substantiated, weak sources, all sorts of speculation. So we stripped it or scrubbed it, I would guess, of above 90, 95% of what was originally in the talk that Powell was going to do. We did this over the course of about 3-4 days nonstop work. And we finally got it to the point where we thought it was intellectually responsible. And we specifically asked people in the intelligence community whether they were comfortable. And if you remember, he had George Tenet sitting behind them when he delivered the speech to send that message. Now, at the end of the day, he was wrong, we were wrong. There were some things in it that were obviously shown that were presented as the case that obviously weren't. But you know, people have to remember this is intelligence. It's always best estimates. It's judgments. And what really gets under my skin and got under his is the idea. Look, we know we were wrong, but the idea that there was any intent there, that there was any lying. No, sometimes you get it wrong. You can make mistakes and be intellectually honest at the same time, and that's what that this was. But it was. The irony of it was here was someone who was skeptical about the war from the get-go, and he was the one who had to carry the water publicly. But we would have gone, look, we went to war without the second UN vote. All these people who are so critical of him forget.
Yeah.
That getting the UN at that point on our side was for the 43rd president, essentially, it was not necessary. It was desirable, but not necessary. We ultimately went without international support. So what everything Powell said at that point, that wasn't driving the policy. That was a way to sell the policy, not drive the policy.
Yeah. And finally, let's talk about the last public phase of his life. And so often, starting in 2008, it was Colin Powell being critical of his former party, the party of his youth, the party that made him, whose politicians made him the leader that he was. But he spoke out against the extreme elements of the Republican Party, and in fact was very critical of Donald Trump and what he believed was his move away from Western-style liberal democracy. Talk about the courage that he's shown when, let's face it, Richard, so many of your peers from the past and so many of mine from the past have not had the courage to speak out against the Republican Party.
Look, he was a moderate Republican, with the emphasis in some ways on the word moderate. Powell was not ideological. His temperament was one of moderation. And he was totally uncomfortable with what he saw. And these people aren't conservative. They're radicals.
Right.
And his moderation was very uneasy with this. He would judge people by people first rather than party affiliation, which is why he could support people who weren't Republicans. No, I think he was generally worried and genuinely offended by what he saw. The other thing about the last 10, 15 years of his life, Joe, was not just that, but essentially he committed himself to making good on what he saw as his own life, which was the fulfillment of the American dream, the immigrant, you know, ROTC, having this extraordinary life. So he did two things. One was America's Promise, which you know, the charity, the NGO. The other was at the City University of New York. We're not talking Harvard here. We're not talking Yale or Princeton. City University of New York. Most of the students, first-generation Americans, most of them from families that had never sent a kid to school. You have the Colin Powell Center and all that. It was a hands-on teaching experience where now probably hundreds or even thousands of young people who have come to this country have also now gotten a really, really good education, and many of them interested in public service. So when he'd go around the country speaking, that was his message. It was the most positive, believe in the country, but there was increasingly a disconnect between what was happening in the Republican Party and in American political life. And I think that will explain the outpouring to his death, that he represented in some ways something we're not seeing much of anymore. John F. Kennedy would have recognized it in Profiles in Courage. It's people who showed character and virtue and stood against the crowd. And that's who he was.
All right. Richard Oz, President of the Council on Foreign Relations and longtime colleague and friend of Colin Powell. Thank you so much for being with us today. I greatly appreciate it.
Good to be with you, my friend.
Thanks so much, Richard. We greatly appreciate you being with us today. And thank you so much for listening to the Joe Scarborough Podcast, remembering the life and the legacy of General Colin Powell. We'll see you next time.